Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The civil rights movement was marked by predominantly peaceful marches. When violence did erupt, it was usually perpetrated by those opposed to a movement that pricked the conscience of America in its demands for equal rights, equal opportunity, and integration. Recent protests around the country have centered on police brutality and particularly police interactions with African Americans. We've witnessed a series of overly aggressive tactics that have resulted in the deaths primarily of black men. But the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police unleashed something in America. We are now in a third week of protests that have filled the streets of cities across the nation, and what's happening now is reminiscent of the civil rights protests of the 60s in that demands for criminal justice reforms are at their core demands for equal rights and equal protection under the law. But unlike the protests of 50 years ago, more Americans are involved. These marches aren't sporadic, but daily events, and they are occurring simultaneously in cities in every part of the nation. Are we witnessing the birth of a new civil rights movement, or is this a continuation of the one started so many years ago? What do today's demands tell us about where we are, how far we've come, and how much farther we have to go? State Representative Kelly Alexander has worked most of his life for civil rights, following in his father's footsteps, a leader whose home was bombed in his efforts to that end in 1965. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
Kelly Alexander Sr., just for those who may not know, was known as Mr. NAACP. And of course, they are the nation's oldest civil rights organization, and guiding that organization's ongoing efforts here in Charlotte is Corinne Mack, president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg branch. Nice to have you with us again, too.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Jennifer Dixon McKnight is an assistant professor at Winthrop University's College of Arts and Sciences, teaching courses in African American history, as well as U.S., women's, and gender history. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And let me start with you, Jennifer Dixon McKnight. You're the historian here. What is your take on what's happening right now? Is this a new movement, or is this just another chapter in a long, long effort?
I would argue, and again, thank you for having me on the show this morning. I would argue that we have to consider this moment as a part of a much, much longer, far more complex movement. We tend to refer back to the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, but I think it's important that we understand this moment not as a new movement, but as a continuation. We can take, I would argue, and scholars, many other scholars would argue that the civil rights movement, if we think about it in terms of how movement has been defined, in terms of organized resistance, in terms of organized protests, in terms of organized movement towards a particular end, particularly as it pertains to the African-American experience, we can look back as far as slave rebellion. In terms of movement, civil rights movement, scholars will refer to the Underground Railroad as one of the earliest iterations of civil rights movement. And so this is honestly nothing new. And there are a number of key moments that sort of set us up and bring us to the moment we're in right now. If we think about someone like a Denmark Vesey, going back to 1822 out of Charleston, South Carolina, someone who was able, even though the insurrection did not actually happen, he has been noted to have organized, some sources argue, thousands of slaves and sympathetic whites to form a rebellion out of Charleston, South Carolina. So if we're talking about sort of organized resistance, this is something that has been going on in this country for generations, for centuries at this point.
If you go back to the abolitionist movement, there were always white people involved in helping black people, not enough, but always white people in helping black people achieve equality and civil rights right through Reconstruction up to the civil rights movement. But something seems profoundly different about what's happening in the streets right now, Kelly Alexander, because there are a lot of white people in the streets right now. And I'm curious what it was about the murder of George Floyd that made people of all races and I would say almost all nationalities, because this has become international in scope, to say enough is enough. What made that? What pushed that button?
Well, what's been going on, I call it the pressure cooker effect. It's been a number of things over a period of years that have contributed to people slowly beginning to see that what we have been saying about different kinds of treatment of black and brown people by police is real. Early on, I think it was dismissed, but with the advent of this little device that just about everybody's carrying, a cell phone with a camera, mm-hmm. and the ability to upload things almost instantaneously to the internet, and it allows large numbers of people to see almost in real time what's going on. That's different. That's a game changer. We no longer have to wait for some intermediary to publish it in the newspaper, develop the film and put it on. I mean, we began to see this in the 60s, when for the first time you got the visualization of what was happening in civil rights protest. You got to be able to see what was going on in Vietnam every evening. Well, we're not waiting now. Everybody is their own publisher. Everybody's their own cameraman. And this means that the events are connecting directly into the psyche of America.
You know, back in when Selma happened, and it was on television, those black and white pictures of attack dogs going after peaceful protesters and fire hoses being turned on them, that shocked America. I think these videos that we're seeing of police interactions with particularly African-American men, have shocked America, but it's an ongoing stream of them that we've seen over the last several years. That doesn't shock you. It makes it undeniable, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And it means that for the first time, we've had over 200 cities that have had spontaneous demonstrations, protests, whatever you want to call them, and that the vast majority of them have been integrated. You've had demonstrations now in places where it might be difficult to get six black folks together, but people are still marching with signs that say Black Lives Matter. That's a game changer.
Yes. Corinne, I know that you are impatient about change. I've read your comments in the newspaper over the years, and particularly in recent days. But do you think that these social media messages that are undeniably speeding up this change, and we'll talk about some of the things that are happening around the country, are doing it in ways that cannot be ignored and are playing right into your hands, because you will get the change you want as a result of this?
Well, I don't know if it's playing into my hands. I think that African-American folks in masses have been impatient. I've just been more vocal about it, quite mm-hmm. frankly. But I think that social media is a positive as well as a negative, because, you know, we have trolls. We have folks who put out negative images of African-Americans every single day. And we have people who simply do not want to believe that Black lives matter. And so, though I am hopeful and I'm trusting God that He is going to guide us to victory in this particular situation, there's so much to do. We're talking about layers of systemic racism. We're talking about over 400 years of oppression. And we're talking about having people begin to have self-examinations. When I say people, I mean all people. Self-examinations about the possibility of their implicit bias and how they themselves have done harm to Black people. We're talking about a system that more likely than not uses the term people of color to kind of water down the concerns of Black people in the 400 years that we've been oppressed. And so I'm very consistent about talking about Black lives and the stolen Black lives and the harmed Black lives, because the NAACP will advocate for all people, but it was founded on two things. It was founded on civil rights and the suffrage movement. White women have won the right to vote, but Black people still have not won the respect and the acceptance of being equal.
I'm curious about, and you've been nodding vigorously during this whole thing, Dr. Dixon McKnight, and I want to come to you in a second. But Corina, I'm curious about your, I'm not sure it was a criticism, but your observation that people have used the word people of color, the words people of color instead of Black. And I think they're doing that to be more inclusive of all minorities who suffer from some of the same things that Black people have suffered from in this country forever. But in the name of your organization are the words colored people. It's the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. So why do you object to that?
Remember when this organization was founded? When it was founded, we were called colored people.
Right, exactly.
We've evolved. We've evolved. And you're right. Other races have been oppressed. But I'm talking specifically about the 400 years mm-hmm. of Black harm that has never, ever been resolved. There has been no restoration for Black people. And that's why I'm being very specific. And I know that the doctorate will speak more about it, but it's important that we deal with the harms to Black people, because if we acknowledge the harms to Black people, if we begin to look at ways to restore Black people, everyone else is going to be blessed also. That is my belief. And so I think it's very important that we deal with that.
Dr. Dixon McKnight, as I said, you've been nodding vigorously as Corinne Mack has been talking. So let me let you jump in there and add your 2 cents worth here, which is worth a lot more than 2 cents. I just want to tell you that.
I agree 100% with both what Ms. Mack and Representative Alexander have said. I would like to add, I think it's what's really interesting about this moment, from a historical perspective, and the thing that I find really frustrating is, you know, we talk about the omission or sort of the language being used in terms of color, people of color, to sort of water down the experience of African Americans and the impact of the past, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years for African Americans. But what I think is also interesting about this moment is we also still see the absence of a discussion about how this moment is impacting African American women in particular. And we also have to embrace the fact that in addition to the issue of race that we're grappling with, there's also the issue of gender that we're having to grapple with. And we have to also grapple with the issue of class. In regards to the issue of gender in particular, you know, and this isn't at all to undermine the depth, the devastation of the experience of African American men.
Well, let me stop. We'll come back and we'll pick up there because I got to stop and make, okay. We'll take a break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Representative Kelly Alexander from the State Legislature, District 107. Corinne Mack is president of the Charlotte Mecklenburg chapter of the NAACP. And Dr. Jennifer Dixon McKnight is an assistant professor of American of African-American history, U.S. and women's and gender history as well at Winthrop University. And we were talking about, you were talking about, Doctor, just prior to the break, about remembering that this is not just about Black lives, it's about gender and other aspects of diversity. Mm-hmm. Continue that line of thought.
Well, you know, I was just saying that the issue of gender has been one or has been a point of contention within the civil rights movement. As long as there's been a movement, there has been a tendency to either overlook, ignore, or in some cases sidestep the contributions and the impact of these moments on the experiences of African-American women. And it's really interesting how we see this playing out in the media right now, the language that's being used. You know, when we're talking about many of the headlines that are being pushed for right now, focus on George Floyd, but they do not talk as much about Breonna Taylor. Hmm. We also see a lot of the media pushing forward a discussion about Black Lives Matter, but we're not talking about, and we see a very male-centered narrative being pushed forward, but we're not even, you know, sort of wrapping our brains around the three women who were at the center of developing or establishing Black Lives Matter. When we talk about the history of the civil rights movement, that has been one of the issues, that we have a number of women like Ella Baker, like Fannie Lou Hamer, Joanne Robinson, Ann Moody, who were sort of at the core of the movement. Even when we go back to the NAACP's history, we often talk about W.E.B. Du Bois, we talk about Monroe Trotter, but we don't talk about Ida B. Wells as one of those individuals who was a part of the founding of the organization. And so we have to also make sure that when we're having these discussions, that we not just broaden a discussion about what civil rights movement is and what it has been. We have to also broaden our discussion about who has been at the center of it. And it's not about giving credit to anyone in particular. It's about understanding the fullness of what the movement has been. And so that we can sort of do a better job of framing what's happening right now.
As long as we're talking about leaders in this movement, Kelly Alexander, your father was a leader. You've been a leader in this. Obviously, all the women that Dr. Dixon just mentioned have been leaders in this. But there's something interesting about what's happening in the streets right now. The civil rights marches of the 50s and 60s were led by mm-hmm. people like Martin Luther King Jr. and others. These are leaderless marches. These are organically formed groups of people who have come out in the street to protest. How has that happened in your mind without leaders?
Well, part of it, again, it's this technological backbone that allows people to connect directly with each other. And you remember this thing about flash mobs? Mm-hmm. Where a group of people all of a sudden decide that they're going to be at a given place at a given time. And it's kind of like an extension of that phenomena where individuals make up their mind about what they want to do and they get the information out broadly. Somebody else sees it, picks it up, and collectively people decide that they're going to show up at 6 o'clock at Marshall Park. And they do it. And once they are there, it only takes a small number of folks to start the chanting mm-hmm. or the singing or to decide, let's march down this street. So it is organic. And because it's so organic and because it's happening in so many places, I believe we are at an inflection point that some of the cultural assumptions that have underlied a lot of what Corrine and Dr. McKnight have been talking about are being challenged. This whole notion, for instance, of white supremacy is being challenged. This notion that just because you are older, you know better is being challenged. So our culture is at a point where we are either going to be able to change things, and it's beginning to focus in on whether or not, because this is an election year, whether or not we are going to move away from Trump and Trumpism and all that that has brought us, and we're going to move into electing people who actually will want to work together to try to come up with policies to help improve the situation.
Well, that was my next question. It has to do with a leaderless movement. Around the time of the economic downturn, two movements sprang up, the Tea Party movement and the Wall Street movement. Occupy Wall Street. Occupy Wall Street was pretty much leaderless. It was an organic movement. And the Tea Party movement, leaders quickly emerged in that, and are many of them are now in Congress. I'm wondering, these protests are so large and in every major city in the country at the moment, they're having an immediate impact. But can they have an ongoing impact unless leaders, in fact, emerge from these demonstrations?
I think some of us have to take a cue from what the people in the streets are saying and demanding. And if we are in positions where we can do something legislatively or do something from our bully pulpits, we've got to do it. You know, you remember that famous quote from, Gandhi, where, you know, he would say that he has to hurry up and catch up with what the people want because they're leading. We're kind of in a Gandhi moment right now. Mm-hmm.
Corrine, yesterday marked the fifth anniversary of the shooting at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, and immediately following that, within weeks, the Confederate flag, which had been flying since 1860 in front of the State House in Columbia, finally came down at the behest of a Republican governor. But that's pretty much it. I mean, other people called for Confederate monuments to be taken down, but for the most part, they remained. This protest has already resulted in Confederate monuments coming down. I think one of Jefferson Davis in the capital of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia. We've seen a ban on Confederate flags at NASCAR races. We have seen people call for name changes on buildings, including Vance High School here in Charlotte, the UNC system, which toyed with the idea of changing the names on some of their buildings because they were named after people who were either slave owners or who were racists. Now they're saying maybe the time has come. The zeitgeist is right for this. Is this the beginning of the end for these symbols of the Confederacy and racist oppression?
I don't know if it's the beginning of the end, but I hope that those who are listening to me hear me very clearly. I don't know any other country that would go to war and the losing group still has monuments memorializing their greatness in their country. My understanding is that we went to war. It was a civil war and the Confederate lost. Anywhere else in the world, it would be considered treasonous to be flying their flag. But in this country, folks say it's their heritage. But that heritage is birthed out of racism and oppression of a people, millions of people. And here we are 401 years later, and we're still talking about slavery. And we're still talking about the harms to Black people. And we're still talking about monuments that we, Black people, have to pass by every single day. Or streets that we have to pass by every single day, like Stonewall. I don't mind you putting those monuments in a museum for those who want to go and pay to look at American history. But when you allow it to be in front of state buildings, when you allow it to be in the White House or on the lawn of the White House, when you allow it to be on the streets that we live on every single day, what you're saying in this country is that you still believe that that's the right way to live. and so that it was okay.
You're the historian here, Dr. Dixon McKnight. Let's talk about this for just a couple of seconds. Are these monuments, are they a testimony to a way of life that came prior to the Civil War and the valiant efforts on the part of some people's forefathers to fight what they viewed as an aggressive northern incursion into their way of life? Or, given the fact that most of these monuments were put up during the beginnings of Jim Crow, in the late 1800s, the early 1900s, are they really a symbol of an in-your-face message sent back then that you are, if you're a black person, you will not be treated equally?
That's it.
I think that this is one of the complicated parts of the history. I was having a conversation last night with one of my colleagues about this, trying to figure out the balance. Meaning, how do we embrace what is our national history without glorifying what has been the horrific experiences of African Americans by way of racial violence, by way of discrimination, by way of racism, oppression, exclusion, and the list goes on. It's one of those things, if you think about it in terms of a relationship, the nation hasn't established a firm enough, a solid enough foundation with the African American community to have these types of symbols not, for us as a community, reflect oppression, exclusion, discrimination, violence, and so forth. If these monuments had been erected in the context of a balanced, of a racially harmonious, of a fair and just nation, if they had been erected alongside symbols and images of the African American experience, we might be having a different kind of conversation. But because these symbols have been erected, one, with very little historical context, the whole story. So when we talk about the Civil War, for example, right, the South lost, the Union won, the slavery ended. That's pretty much the narrative that we get. We don't get the whole story that African Americans were part of that war as well. We don't get the part of the story where once the Civil War is over, we shift into what we call a nadir period, where African Americans experience segregation, where they experience racial violence, where African Americans transition from being enslaved, not necessarily to freedom, and where lynching becomes a norm, right? We don't talk about that part of it. And so when you put a Confederate statue being erected in the midst of an era where African Americans are being lynched as a common practice, then how are Black people supposed to feel about what those monuments mean? And when you put those things in the context of the African American experience being what it has been, we have to be real clear about the fact that when this nation was formed, it was not formed with Black people as free people in mind. And so when we think about these symbols, what it symbolizes is all of that, right? It's not an effort to undermine or ignore or disregard the nation's history, but we have to figure out a way where we can honor what the nation has been, but also be really honest about what the nation has been.
Kelly Alexander.
And I think in many ways,
Go ahead. In many ways, finish your thought.
Oh, in many ways, I think, not only are these symbols, and that's part of the issue, is that for some people, these Confederate statues and monuments and so forth are a symbol of their heritage and not necessarily racism. But that is not the whole story.
So,
right.
Kelly, given that that is the whole story, Kelly Alexander, you work in Raleigh with a bunch of people who I would imagine some of them would like to see these monuments preserved, and some of them certainly control the UNC Board of Governors, who just now came to the conclusion that perhaps we ought to change the names on some of these buildings. Maybe there's enough support now out there in the world to do that. Do they understand what she just explained about what these symbols mean?
In a word, up until very recently, I think the answer would have been no. I introduced legislation around the Silent Sam issue earlier in the legislative session that simply would have had the statute removed from the campus, put in some state cemetery for Confederates, and you know, we would have moved on. That particular piece of legislation never got a committee hearing, as an example. When you start talking about the use of the Confederate battle flag, for instance, that became popular. We start around the Strom Thurmond's Dixiecrat run for president in the late 40s. And then you get the Brown decision, and you immediately begin to see these symbols of defiance in the minds of people who wanted to maintain white supremacy and did not want the social norms of the time to change. They looked for ways to be in your face to the federal government. And they hid under states' rights rhetoric. They tried to talk about how everything was peachy and dandy down in the South between blacks and whites. And that's how a lot of these symbols became popularized again.
I have 30 seconds. Do you think that the defiance that you spoke of today, maybe back 50 years ago it was different, but today the defiance that people who wave that flag are projecting, is it defiance against black people, we're not going to give you your rights, or is it a defiance to the federal government and others who would want to remove those symbols because that's my heritage?
It's both. There's some people who follow one track and there's some people who follow the other track. When I was in college as an undergraduate, I said once that if you really wanted to get people away from using the Confederate flag, get an ebony shaded black person to run for office and use that as their symbol.
And we'll break and come right back. I'm Mike Collins. Listener support powers the coverage from WFAE that you rely on in good times and bad. As reporters and producers keep you updated on the coronavirus and its impact on the community, we hope that you'll consider a donation to WFAE at WFAE.org or by calling 704-549-9000. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Kelly Alexander, a state representative from District 107 this morning, along with Dr. Jennifer Dixon McKnight, assistant professor in African American history at Winthrop University, and Corrine Mack, president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg NAACP, about where we are in terms of our timeline in the struggle for civil rights and what the current demonstrations may mean for that, among other things. Corrine, I'm curious about education. These police videos that we've seen are allowing people, black people have been saying for years they've been unjustly treated by police, and perhaps people didn't believe it until they saw it, and then they saw it again and again and again and again. Is part of the problem here, the part of the difficulty in this struggle towards civil rights, the lack of people not really getting it, not really understanding the history of it, Corrine?
I think that's part of it. I think for the most part, let me go back. And you know, we have white allies now who finally realize that black lives have been stolen at the hands of police. But I think things like educational inequity, the criminal justice system, that's an unjust system as it pertains to black people. The issue around housing and the lack thereof. in every other facet of life is not something people can readily understand because it doesn't affect them directly. The reason why people are beginning to realize there's something wrong is because they watched for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. Mm-hmm. A black man's face pushed to the ground with a white man who was in uniform, who took an oath to protect and serve, with his knee in the neck of a man. And as people told him, "You're killing him, let him go," as Mr. Floyd pleaded for his life and called out to his mother, as the other officers notified him that there was no longer any response, he still stayed there with his knee in his neck. That symbol is a symbol for all black people, because we feel like there's always a knee in our neck. But more importantly, now we have an opportunity to have a real conversation. And that conversation may not be educating at first. It may be simply having a conversation to get people to at least open up to the realization of our black plight. Then we can move into going back to 1619 and really diving deeper into what has happened to black people and the black experience. But that is also going to take people being willing to, as I said earlier before, having that self-examination to understand that they have implicit bias. And how do we begin to bring that bias to the top and remove all of the dross so that people can start to say, okay, I felt this way because this is what's been ingrained in me for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. Now I can see that black people are in fact treated inhumanely, that they're not treated equally, and we got to build equity.
And another aspect of this, and you're the history professor here, and I watched the 60 Minutes episode on Sunday night where they talked to people in Tulsa, black people in Tulsa, about what happened in 1921 in Tulsa, where white people, it was an enclave of highly successful African Americans. It was referred to as the Wall Street of Tulsa. And white people, they weren't going to have it. So they went in and literally destroyed everything about that town, killed people, burnt the town to the ground. And it wasn't even a town. It's part of Tulsa. Nobody knows about that. People in the African-American community there said they lived there their whole lives, never heard about it, never was taught about it in school. Same is true in Wilmington, North Carolina, with what happened there in 1898, which was, right, I think, the only coup d'etat in the history of the country. It was called at the time, Wilmington was called the freest town for a Negro in the country. And white people came in and removed people, duly elected people, from office. And we don't know about it. How many other travesties like that, Doctor, are there that we don't know about?
We could be here from now until the end. One of the things that I, struggle with in teaching African American history and even teaching U.S. history, because I really make it an effort to teach a more inclusive history, and that's not just in terms of race, it's also in terms of class and gender, is that I often get pushback from students. And I also get sort of the light bulb, which is the moment I love when I see the light bulb going off around the room. Because so many of my students that come into my classroom at the college level, many of them have never had a course in African American history. And most of them, with the information that they've been given, they get the same sort of catchphrase: Dr. King, Rosa Parks, slavery happened, and that was pretty much it. And even, going back to our discussion about the civil rights movement in general, we typically focus on it in the 1950s and 60s without understanding of how the movement has evolved over time. And I think you mentioned something about a leaderless movement. I mean, this is one of the issues that we face in terms of education at a moment like this, that when we think about earlier moments in the civil rights movement, many times in moments like what happened in Tulsa, moments like what happened in Wilmington, even going back to Hayti and Durham, North Carolina, we look at the rich history in Charleston, North Carolina, the work that I do on the hospital worker strike in 1969, in these moments, these individuals don't see themselves as activists. They see themselves as day-to-day folks who are fighting against a moment of oppression. And so they aren't necessarily focused on leadership. They're focused on advancing. They're focused on resolution, right? But often when we talk about this history, we don't really dig into it. We are suffering with a educational system that gives our students the same sort of 4 or 5 minutes of the history. Many times they get it during Black History Month, and they don't get it any other time of the year. And when they do get it, it is often either inaccurate or incomplete. Our curriculum doesn't allow for a more expanded sort of digging into African American history, Native American history, women's history, the list goes on and on and on. But getting back to African American history in particular, part of the struggle is it's uncomfortable. The conversations we're having to have right now, they're uncomfortable. When we talk about race, it's uncomfortable. And so how do we get to a point where we have to start educating our children? We make it necessary that our children have a clear understanding about what has happened in our nation. So it's not just talking about World War I, World War II, the Civil War, and colonists. You know, I was teaching American history before I got the other side of the Thanksgiving story. Between when we talk about back then we called them pilgrims and Indians, which of course is inappropriate and not politically correct. But I was in college teaching history before I got the other half of that story, before I understood that it wasn't harmonious, that it ended in slaughter. So that's the point that I'm getting to, is that the lack of education is devastating, and it's going to have a far-reaching and devastating effect if we don't start to sort of make this something more mandatory. We have to make it more widespread, but that leads into curriculum reform and questions about how to adjust or make adjustments in our educational system.
And victors always write the history books, so it's their version of it. The New York Times, Kelly Alexander, the New York Times reports that white Americans are going through a wave of self-examination, buying books about racism, talking to Black friends, and arguing within their own families, it says. They also say that at a recent protest in New York, 61% of the 195 randomly chosen survey participants were white, 65% in Washington were white, 53% in Los Angeles were white. What, if anything, can we read into that? And is that a mark of progress, an indication that this time real change might occur? Kelly.
Well, as I said before, we are at an inflection point. And like most inflection points, we can either tip it in one direction or it's going to fall back to the status quo antebellum. I believe that it's incumbent upon all of us to do what we can to make sure that things don't go back, that we learn from this present moment and we move ahead to try to improve things. This whole discussion, for instance, about quote, defunding the police, is really a discussion about what law enforcement ought to look like, how it should relate to the broader community, whether or not we should be looking at police as guardians or as warriors. I think the guardian model makes more sense. I think this whole idea of some of the things that we have tasked police with doing are probably inappropriate. If there's a domestic disturbance, do you want somebody to show up that's armed to the teeth first, or do you want a social worker to show up? If there's somebody that's having a mental breakdown, do you want a psychologist to show up first, or do you want somebody armed? These are some discussions that are for the first time going on. This whole thing about qualified immunity, should it change? If you believe that some of these changes are necessary, it's time for you to not only just march in the street, but to reach out to those people who can make a difference and change these things. You got to communicate with your legislators. You've got to communicate with your folk in Congress. You've got to communicate with your senators. You got to express what you believe as a citizen should be the new norm. If you fail to do that, we're going to get not anything that's new, but simply a modified version of the status quo.
As long as we're talking about police, Corey Mack, you've been very critical of CMPD and their efforts during these recent demonstrations. And I know that they're coming out next week. Chief Putney told me yesterday that they're coming out next week with proposals for change. What has to change? And how quickly does it have to change?
The entire policing system has to be reformed. Quite frankly, I sent in 24 bullets, pardon the pun, that I believe needs to change. But I want to go. I want to go a little deeper about policing. We have to remember that policing was founded on racism. The initial responsibility of the law and law enforcement was to ensure that slaves did not run away and leave the land of the master. Okay. And so when you think about why policing was so important and why for Black people, it's a problem, it has not changed. Black people are still feeling it very much as if we were being held at a different standard to our white counterparts, and that we are being oppressed in ways that no other group is being oppressed. That's the first thing. Secondly, when you think about the fact that the FBI and the other forms of government have already confirmed that white supremacists have in fact infiltrated the police departments, I'm very concerned with the fact that people don't want to receive that, because I didn't make it up. This is their reports. Back to 2006, they confirmed that white supremacists had been infiltrating police departments all over this country. We have video of officers in full uniform doing white power signs. And so what do you think that means to a Black person every single day in this country, and how we're being treated every single day in this country, when we have thousands of Black people who have been killed by police, and every one of those cases, no one was held accountable? What does it mean to Black people when law enforcement have immunity beyond anyone else? And all I have to say is I felt threatened, when the fact is we've seen video after video when there was no threatening situation. What does it mean that officers are afraid to come forward and tell on an officer they know has made racist statements, that they know have racist postings, that they know have racially motivated intentions? What does it mean to not only the system, but to Black people, you know, at large, when we have vocalized serious concerns for years, not only in the country, but right here in Charlotte, and no response? What does it mean that on June 2nd, we had peaceful protesters ambushed, trapped, and shot at with banned military chemical weapons, and to date, no one has been held accountable?
I have 30 seconds left, and from what I just heard, I think I know the answer to this question, but I'd like to hear very quickly from all three of you on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being where we were during Jim Crow and 10 being problems solved. Where are we? I have 30 seconds. Kelly Alexander.
6 or 7.
Okay. Dr. McKnight.
I would say more along 3 or 4.
And Corrine.
I would say 2 or 3.
Wow. Kelly, get on the same page here.
I'm an optimist.
Yeah, Corrine Mack, president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg NAACP, Dr. Jennifer Dixon McKnight, assistant professor of African-American studies, as well as U.S. history, women's and gender history at Winthrop University, and Kelly Alexander, who represents District 107 in the state legislature. Thank you very much for the hour. I appreciate it. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.